This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with socialist Jeff Mackler, who was a plaintiff in the historic 1986 lawsuit where federal judge Thomas Grisey, recently deceased, held in a historic opinion that it was legal to be a socialist in the United States, to form an organization of socialists, and that it was illegal for the FBI to try to disrupt and destroy their organization. We're also joined by attorney Maria LaHood. She's co-counsel to the Students for Justice in Palestine, who have attempted for the last year and a half to form a chapter at Fordham University in New York City. The students, through their legal team, requested an injunction to force the university to obey their own rules and allow them to organize.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Retired federal judge Thomas Grisey died 2 weeks ago in New York City at the age of 87. He presided over the historic case, Socialist Workers' Party versus the Attorney General. Leonard Boudin, the great leftist constitutional lawyer of his time, was chief counsel for the SWP in the 15-year litigation, which ended in a historic victory in 1986, and which is extremely relevant for today. Boudin wrote that, quote, "This lawsuit represented the first wholesale attack upon the entire hierarchy of the so-called intelligence agencies that had attempted to infiltrate and destroy a lawful political party," unquote. Further, quote, "For the first time, a court has thoroughly examined the FBI's intrusions into the political system of our nation and in unmistakable language has condemned the FBI activity as patently unconstitutional and without statutory or regulatory authority. The decision stands as a vindication of the First and Fourth Amendment rights, not only of the Socialist Workers' Party, but of all political organizations and activists in this country, to be free of government spying and harassment," end quote. The Nation magazine appreciated the significance of the litigation and wrote that, quote, "For the first time, the FBI's disruptions, surreptitious entries, and use of informers has been found unconstitutional. All in all, it amounted to a domestic contra-operation against a lawful and peaceful political organization for no reason other than its ideological orientation," end quote. We speak today with Jeff Mackler, a longtime socialist activist in California and the West Coast head of the Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal. Jeff Mackler was a plaintiff in the successful 15-year-old battle. Jeff is also the National Secretary of Socialist Action, a political party in California, and was its candidate for the United States presidency in 2016. Jeff Mackler, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you.
Jeff, please describe what the Socialist Workers' Party, the SWP, was doing. You were a member at the time. What were they doing? What were their activities? What were their beliefs? And then I'm going to ask you, what did the FBI do against them? But first, let's talk about what the SWP was doing that made them a target for FBI intrusion.
Well, the SWP was a long-standing party, and it had been used to government prosecution. It was the first party in the United States to be prosecuted, with 18 of its leaders sent to jail in the 1941 Smith Act trials under the Roosevelt administration. Even Roosevelt himself later admitted that there was no basis for it. They literally put 18 leading SWPers in jail. The main reason was they were the central leaders of the 1934 Minneapolis Teamsters strike, and they were opposed to the coming war. But the real reason for the government spying was to sideline critics of the administration. The government had been spying on the SWP with literally 1,100 agents FBI agents, informers, or paid persons for literally 40 years. They just assumed that that was the norm, and everybody in the movement at that time knew. The reason they picked on the SWP, they also picked on the Communist Party, the Black Panther Party, Jane Fonda, the NAACP, but the reason the SWP was a target was that it was central to the organization of very broad united coalitions that mobilized millions of people over the course of 10 years against the war in Vietnam. And at the time, the war in Vietnam was the central issue in world politics. The United States was serious about that war. It killed 4 million Vietnamese, and we lost 57,000 Americans. And here you have, coming out of the witch hunt, the Socialist Workers Party, organizing against a war, an ongoing present war, which was practically unknown in the United States, mobilizing against U.S. war policy in the middle of a war and winning the majority of the American people.
What did the FBI do to the organization and members of the organization to try to cripple and ruin them?
Yeah, a variety of things. The first thing is the time the SWP had 50 branches around the country, so it put an average of one person in every branch. It spied on every member. It kept files on them. I had a large FBI file, starting from when I was a student anti-war civil liberties activist. And it otherwise tried to disrupt the SWP's activity. So, for example, if we ran a Clifton DeBerry for President of the United States, which the SWP did at that time, it would literally manufacture letters that DeBerry had not written and send them to movement organizations denouncing them, and the government expected that to stir up trouble and anger and hatred against the SWP, which is trying to bring people together. So it sent false letters, it disrupted activities, it threatened people with loss of their jobs, it went to employers to ask them if they knew that they had a known communist working for them. It tried to stir up dissension in the party and all kinds of other disruptive activities to a legal party.
The things you just described were brought out in the lawsuit. Federal Judge Thomas Grisey presided over it for 15 years. And I wanted to ask you about him. He was what they call an old-fashioned rock-ribbed Republican. He was from an upper-class family. He went to an elite college, an elite law school. He was a partner in the Davis Polk Wardell, a law firm, as a famous powerhouse white shoe law firm here in New York City. He was appointed as a judge by President Nixon to the federal bench in the important Second Circuit here in New York, important because it hears cases involving Wall Street. Yet he wrote three unassailable opinions, and he presided over a 15-year case that finally held that it was legal to be a socialist and to form together in a political party. He barred any further FBI disruptive activity, and for good measure, he fined the FBI $264,000. Even at one point, he threatened to jail the then Attorney General Griffin Bell, and he held the Attorney General in contempt of court. How do you understand what must be conceded to be a commendable role that Judge Grisey played in that lawsuit, yet this was his background? How do you understand that?
Well, there are two factors. The first is that the SWP had the courage to file the suit. Everybody in the movement at that time knew that the FBI was spying on every organization. But the SWP believed that they had no right to do that, and they filed this historic lawsuit. But it wasn't just a lawsuit. They set up a political rights defense fund that got the endorsement of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of trade unions, social organizations, feminist organizations, anti-war organizations. I'm talking about the entire movement. So they created a crescendo effect in defense of civil liberties at the end of the McCarthy era. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the climate in the country had changed. When we started the fight in the 60s against the war in Vietnam, the polls showed that there were 14% who were for bring the troops home now. By the time of Griffin's final decision, the war was over, but the polls showed 75 to 80% of the people were against the war and wanted to end it. It was a massive social movement that changed the climate in the country. The SWP filed a suit at the height of the struggles for black rights. The anti-war movement that the SWP championed was supported by people from Malcolm X to Martin Luther King. We marched with Dr. King in the anti-war movement, where the civil rights and the anti-war movement converged. So in other words, there was a massive change in the climate in the country when people went out into the street and demanded their rights and rejected the entire McCarthy-era thesis. At the beginning of the Vietnam War, for example, the SWP, although it played an important role in the United Coalitions, never had a speaker because we didn't want to subject it to red baiting. 10 years later, socialist speakers on anti-war platforms, not to mention socialists who ran for president of the United States, like Peter Camejo, who got hundreds of thousands of votes in 1976, were a fairly normal phenomenon in American society. So the SWP's lawsuit dovetailed with the fight against McCarthyism, the fight for free speech on the campuses, the fight for civil rights for blacks, and the struggle against imperialist war. It was that climate where Judge Griesa made his decision. And I remember because when he finally, at the last day in court, said to the government before he was going to render his decision, he said, after 40 years of spying on the SWP, 1,100 agents in the party across the country, have you ever found the Socialist Workers' Party to have committed an illegal act? And the government of the United States had to say no, which was a shocking statement in itself. Because the entire justification was that in the interests of national security, this socialist group, which was alleged to, you know, say we wanted to overthrow the government of the United States by force or violence, couldn't mention a single illegal act, not to mention force or violence, at which point the government ruled in our favor. And Griesa ordered the FBI to cease all of its activities. Earlier, Judge Griesa made a shocking ruling, which literally shocked the world, when he ordered the Attorney General of the United States, Griffin Bell, in 1978 to jail. When Griesa said, you are illegally spying on this group, you must turn over the names of all 1,100 FBI agents. And Bell refused. The government ordered him to jail. We had a meeting, and they finally reached a compromise where every single agent in the party, in the government files, every act of spying would be considered prima facie evidence of guilt and finable guilt based on a certain amount for each violation. So Griffin Bell had courage, no doubt, rock rib Nixon Republican notwithstanding. He was not immune from the political atmosphere that the SWP was part of creating. That is a mass social struggle against the prerogatives of American capitalism, racism, and war.
Judge Griesa reviewed four decades of FBI spying and disruption, and he concluded that, quote, this is a quote from one of the decisions, there is no evidence that any FBI informant ever reported an instance of planned or actual espionage, violence, or terrorism. And then he went on to rule, frustrating the growth of the organization and attempts at disruption, that these activities were not lawful. The Justice Department came back and argued that the FBI's inability to come up with any evidence of lawbreaking by the SWP, despite decades of spying, and this is what the Justice Department says, quote, did not of itself make the investigation or the techniques used in it illegal. The FBI was and is authorized to conduct such investigations. They argued that it's reasonable for the FBI and other agencies of the government to believe that the SWP and its members have a revolutionary ideology whose goal is the violent overthrow of our democratic processes and our democratic government. Please talk about their use of the issue of violence.
Well, there are several aspects of this thing. Of course, the overall view of the government was that they were defending the national security interests of the United States. and that is that that central argument defending the so-called national security interests of the United States voided any rights under the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment for association, to privacy, for free speech, for free assembly, for the right to organize a political party. They said, that's all legal. We have those rights. But in the era of communist war and terrorism and all the threats that communism poses to the United States, including violence, the First Amendment rights are subordinated. So during this period, the McCarthy era, so to speak, the First Amendment went out the window, and people were literally thrown into jail, like Frank Wilkinson or Willard Uphaus or Carl Braden, simply for not answering the question, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And if they refused to answer that question on the grounds of the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment was originally used because people were so frightened during the witch hunt that they just said, I have the right against self-incrimination. And they didn't go to jail. But when people said in the 60s, I take the First Amendment, I have the right to my association, they were put in jail for a year or longer, one after another. People were fired for their jobs simply for being a communist. You had to sign a loyalty oath to be a teacher. So this was the fundamental proposition of the United States. The SWP responded, we are a political party and we don't advocate violence. That shocked the government. Of course you advocate violence. The SWC, no. You can't show any piece of literature or individual who stood up and advocates the violent overthrow of the United States government. We do reserve the right under the Constitution to defend ourselves against the source of violence. That is the government of the United States, its wars, its witch hunting, its attacks on trade unions, its banning the right to organize, its banning the right to free speech, and its otherwise persecuting people who have the right to dissent. And not only that, but physically attacking them. So the party argued in the old tradition of the trade unions that we have 100% right to defend our jobs against police violence, against the National Guard. In fact, it's embedded in the Constitution that the right of the people to bear arms should not, cannot be denied. And by that, the government meant, and it was written into literally every state constitution, that the American people have the right to challenge a dictatorial government and defend themselves against governmental abuse. And that was why it was written into the Constitution, that the people had the right to bear arms. The SWP never argued that we should run around having weapons, but it simply said we have the right to defend ourselves against a government that abrogates our rights. It posed itself properly, in my view, as defenders of the right to assembly, the right to march, the right to organize. And it posed the government of a minority capitalist class as those, as the institution that threatened the democratic rights of the people. That was what the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights itself was all about. So the SWP never went around saying, we have the right to organize violent activities. And of course, the government couldn't present a single evidence. I think there was even a quip, and maybe it's my imagination, when that moment came and the government said, in the 40 years we've been spying on the SWP, we've never found an illegal act. I think the government might have said, or Judge Teresa might have said, not even a parking ticket. And that was not only humorous, it was true. And of course, there were other organizations on the left who believed that the rhetoric of violence was going to be their winning card, running around saying to the people, let's get organized, let's pick up the gun, let's shoot the cops, let's off the pig, and all that kind of stuff. That gave the government a pretext to say this is a violent organization. The government literally had 1,100 people embedded in the party in one form or another and never found an illegal act. And yet the SWP was prominent in the civil rights movement, on labor picket lines, in strike activities, in defense of civil liberties, in lawsuits, in running election campaigns, and doing every other kind of activity that sought to mobilize the American people in massive actions to defend their own rights. And that's why they won the support of tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who believe that any party has the right to organize the American people to fight for change.
We're speaking with Jeff Mackler, who was a plaintiff in the historic case, the Socialist Workers Party versus the Attorney General. Jeff, I wanted to ask you how the case was organized and how support was garnered. The Political Rights Defense Committee, PRDF, was formed to garner wide support for the lawsuit. It was an extraordinarily successful effort. How'd they do it? What were their guiding principles?
Well, it was PRDF, Political Rights Defense Fund, and it was an organization with a professional staff and offices, and it had a statement of purpose. We simply defend the right of the Socialist Workers' Party to, under the Constitution, to free speech, free assembly, free association, and to organize people to protest the policies of the United States government. It was a simple statement of purpose. And we took that into organizations like the National Education Association, trade unions across the country, union locals, and one after another, understanding that the government attacked them as well, said, yes, we support the SWP lawsuit. So we would go to union conventions, and we had members in scores of unions across the country and social organizations, civil liberties groups, and we won their support with a massive concerted effort. The party at that time had some 3,000 members, including its youth group, the Young Socialist Alliance. So they were on a campaign footing. They made that an integral part of their presidential election campaign. But they went to every social organization fighting for justice in one form or another and said, will you support our case? And by the way, the SWP was the only organization in the United States that had the position that the First Amendment and the constitutionally protected rights of the Bill of Rights had to be enjoyed by us. The government came to us and they said, listen, we promise we'll never spy on you again. And we'll give you, like they proposed to give to the NAACP or Jane Fonda, we'll give you a dollar and we promise we'll never spy on you again, unless it's necessary to protect the national security interests of the United States. Virtually every other organization that had filed a suit accepted that proposition. They accepted the witch hunt proposition that the government had the right to spy if it was so supposedly protecting the interests of the United States government. The SWP said no. Well, the government said, well, okay, a dollar is a little cheap. How about, you know, $1,000, $1 million, or $5 million? And we promise we'll never spy on you unless it's necessary to protect the national security. And the government and the SWP said no. That's why the decision before Grisa was so important. The SWP demonstrated to the world that it wasn't interested in a court settlement where we got money, whether it be $1 or $1 million. We refused that argument, the national security argument, and we said the American people have the right to organize. And that very principled and proud position won it the support of thousands of individuals and organizations everywhere. And when we won that victory, the only such victory ever, it was quite unexpected. It was a major break with the McCarthy-era witch hunt national security ideology.
We're speaking with Jeff Mackler, who was a plaintiff in the historic lawsuit, a longtime, lifelong socialist, lives out in California. Jeff, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you your evaluation of the historic period that we're in now and why you think that the victory back in 86 is important and relevant to today's times.
Well, that's an incredible question because, as you know, the President of the United States, the former President, President Obama, under the Patriot Act and other legislation that was approved by the Bush administration after 9/11, they spy on literally every single person in the United States. The American spy apparatus, through control of the Internet, through admitted government tapping. In the old days, it was wiretapping. They used technology to stick in your house to this or your office to find out what you were saying. Now they have the complete records of everyone's computer, virtually everyone in the United States. We're talking tens of millions of people. And the government once again justifies it in the name of the national security interests of the United States. And like in the McCarthy era, they figure they can get away with it because the courts say, yes, we have the right to spy, with some limitations and so on. So That is going to be challenged as well. The reason the government does this is because the system itself is in crisis. It has no solutions to the problems of everyday life of the American people. If there is a problem, they eliminate the unions. We have the lowest representation of unions ever because the government views democratic fighting trade unions as a threat to its national security interest, that is, the national security interests of the ruling class and the rich that run the country. It is running an austerity program that attacks working people on every front, from wages and hours to basic civil rights, pension funds, and a myriad of other attacks on people that have immiserated the conditions of life of broad layers of the American people. Not just blacks and Latinos, who are the first ones to be attacked because they are exploited the greatest, but the general working class. And the government cannot do otherwise than try to solve its problems at the extent of the majority. And therefore, it believes that it needs in place repressive legislation like it did during the McCarthy era, when the American people reached that point where the vast majority begins to take to the streets, like in the 30s, in the Great Depression, in the Civil Rights Movement, in the Vietnam War Movement, and in those same movements today, the right for the right of women to choose, to be free from sexual harassment, the right of people not to be deported, immigrants. Yesterday, the government said 200,000 Salvadorans are going to be deported. 50,000 Haitians are scheduled for deportation. In other words, the government needs to solve the problems at the expense of working people. We live in a terrible society, Mike. We have 7 million people under the jurisdiction of the privatized, for-profit criminal justice system, a majority black, Latino, and Native American. They work in these privatized prisons at 50 cents an hour. Why hire a Latino immigrant for the minimum wage of $758 an hour when you can have a near slave for 50 cents an hour? Those are the conditions that permeate the consciousness of the American people, and the government is not stupid. They know that the people are going to organize and fight back, and they want to prepare in advance the institutional, the legal, in quotes, framework in order to introduce repression to maintain the interests of the 1%. Socialists are very confident that working people have no interest in austerity, in attacks on their wages and conditions and housing and lives and environment, the right to breathe fresh air, not to mention not to freeze to death in New York because of the melting of the Arctic ice caps, or to have your state burned down like California fires because of global warming. It pursues fossil fuel because it's profitable regardless of the cost in human life or to the planet itself. So we are living in a rapacious system. The American people will not tolerate this forever. They are going to increasingly organize and fight for their democratic right to do so, and we can count on the government to challenge that right, like every government, every minority government has done from the beginning of time. Our strength is that we represent the highest aspirations of humanity in the American people. They want to live in a free society. They want free association. They want the right to organize to defend their rights. They want to live a decent life, and that is in jeopardy in the United States as never before. So I think the coming battles are going to be tremendously successful, especially because of the previous groundwork laid by those who defended the fundamental right to association, to free speech, to free assembly, to fight back, to organize people to redress the grievances of the government. In the course of that, the socialist movement will grow. I'm a member of a national organization of socialists called Socialist Action. Young people are joining our group, not so much because of the moral crisis of capitalism today, which is true, but because young people can't expect the kind of future that our generation, yours and mine, had when the United States was living in an era of prosperity. During the Vietnam War, the United States tripled the money that went into public education and spent billions of dollars on war. And that's because the United States emerged from World War II as the only victor. Our allies and enemies alike were destroyed. We had a monopoly of trade and control and debt in the entire world. Today, we are a government in crisis with massive debt. And a government, for example, that just had to grant $1.5 trillion over 10 years in tax relief. Stupid President Trump, if I may say this on your radio program, claimed that the tax relief for the rich was $5.5 trillion and not 1.5. He's probably closer to the truth because the government always cooks the books. So I think we are in for a major fight back in the coming years, and the pioneering work of all those in the civil rights, anti-war, social justice, civil liberties movement will stand us in good stead. The SWP, admittedly, was a small part of that. Their strength came from the American people and not any conspiracy against the United States government.
Well, Jeff Mackler, well said. We truly appreciate your being on Law and Disorder, and we appreciate your good work over the years. And we wish you good luck, and thank you again for being on Law and Disorder.
Mike, thanks for your wonderful program. It's invaluable to the movement.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Israel's enablers in the United States ramped up their efforts to shut down the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS. Many states, including New York, have passed laws against businesses who would boycott Israel as a way of protesting Israel's colonization of the Palestinian people. An anti-boycott bill is currently before the United States Congress. In New York City, Fordham University is attempting to prevent Students for Justice in Palestine, a group that supports the boycott, from forming a campus group. The students brought a lawsuit seeking an injunction against the university to enable them to establish an SJP chapter there. Keith Eldridge, the dean at Fordham University, took the position that SJP was a group that would create polarization on campus, and that what they do runs contrary to the mission and values embraced at the university. The students got help from the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal. A suit was brought on their behalf in April of last year. 2 weeks ago, a hearing was held in New York's civil court where the students demanded an injunction against Fordham University to permit them to form a chapter. We speak today with Maria LaHood, one of the students' attorneys and the deputy legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Maria LaHood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
The First Amendment protects free speech and freedom of association, but that right doesn't apply to Fordham University because it's not a state school. The dean of students at Fordham, Keith Eldridge, denied school recognition to the Students for Justice in Palestine on the grounds that it would create polarization, that would run contrary to the mission and values embraced at Fordham. How did you counter that argument?
That's what Dean Eldridge first said when he denied SJP approval. Then when CCR and Palestine Legal wrote Fordham and said, you can't do that, you guarantee freedom of expression, the vice president of student affairs responded, well, it was actually because of conduct by other SJPs on other campuses, and that's why we denied this SJP. Then later in the litigation, Eldridge brought up for the first time supposed safety and security concerns, again, based on what other SJPs had purportedly done, but acknowledging that he didn't know if those reports were even true or not. The decision on its at its base was irrational, but even though the First Amendment doesn't apply to Fordham, which is a private Jesuit university, New York has what's called an Article 78 proceeding, which permits you to challenge administrative decisions, whether it's by a government agency, a corporation, or an institution, to ensure that they're complying with their own internal rules and that their decisions are rational. And that's how we brought this case.
The university said that it believes that a student club bearing the name SJP is not in the best interests of our students on either side of the debate and would not serve to foster reasoned discussion of these very difficult issues. What was your response to that?
Well, I mean, obviously it's painfully patronizing, but the United Students Government, which is actually the body that until this decision had always been tasked with approving student clubs, they found the exact opposite. They found that an SJP would actually foster discussion and would be very good for campus debate. We also submitted an affidavit in the case by Ben Lorber, the campus coordinator for JVP, and he said that, you know, he works with SJP and Jewish Voice for Peace groups on campuses all over the United States, and students are grateful for their presence because they actually open debate, they permit discussion of things that weren't discussed before, and that's from students on different sides of the issue.
Fordham said it would grant the club status under a slightly revised version of their constitution that they had proposed, which would include requiring the students to change the name of their club and overtly state its independence, financial and otherwise, from the national SJP. Why did you not accept that offer?
Well, first of all, this offer was never made to the students before Fordham vetoed their club. Second of all, the students had repeatedly stated their independence from both other SJPs on other campuses and National Students for Justice in Palestine. Upon the request of the administrators, they actually wrote it into their constitution saying we're independent. They got written confirmation from an SJP that they're independent. NSJP's website says that they're all autonomous. So there was no confusion as to that fact. But to the main point, the students didn't want a different name. They wanted to be Students for Justice in Palestine. That name connects them to the broader movement for justice for Palestinians. It has a political significance, obviously. And why shouldn't they have the name they want? Why shouldn't they describe themselves as who they are? They are Students for Justice in Palestine.
Fordham said that the group encourages disruptive conduct, and that contradicted the college's values of what they said, quote, civility. Isn't that what Professor Stephen Salida was charged with when he was fired from a tenured position at the University of Illinois, that he was uncivil?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, civility, whether it's civility or whether it's controversy or polarization, as Dean Eldridge said, those are all terms, especially in civility, that have been used really to marginalize groups and to silence groups, whether it's been groups for social justice, whether it's been Native Americans, whether it's been civil rights groups. It's used in order to try to silence. And here it's no different.
What kind of support did the students have? Was the courtroom packed?
Yes, it was amazing. It was, you know, the hearing was on January 3rd, 2 days after New Year's. It was freezing cold out in New York City, and yet the courtroom was overflowing. You know, there were many people who couldn't get in. Estimates were 100 people showed up to support the students. So it was great. The students were thrilled with the turnout to see all that support, to know that people are there for them because they're basically out there alone.
Well, you haven't gotten a decision yet, but was the demeanor of the judge indicative of something positive?
It was. We were quite pleased. You know, Alan Levine, who's a longtime CCR cooperating counsel, did the argument. The Judge Bannon was receptive. She was engaged. She was very thoughtful. You know, at one point, right from the get-go, she asked, her first question to Alan was, well, can't Fordham sanction the students if they violate the code of conduct at Fordham? You know, and of course they can. I mean, there's no reason to speculate that perhaps there will be some disruptive conduct or there will be something. It made no sense to ban SJP. They can always take measures to enforce their rules afterwards if necessary. And she seemed to acknowledge that. One of the things, you know, although they've said all along, it's the name, SJP. If they change the name, you know, they haven't said it all along. They've said it recently. If they change the name SJP, they can have their club. Later in the argument, they said, and we don't want groups against specific states, and we don't want groups endorsing BDS. So it was clear political motivation. But when Allen said, I doubt that they would have prevented a club against apartheid in South Africa, Judge Bannon made a comment about Northern Ireland. So I think she, you know, expressed some understanding of movements for self-determination against colonial oppression, and that was great.
What would a chapter at Fordham of the SJP do if it got the green light from the judge?
You know, its mission is to build support in the Fordham community for justice and human rights and liberation for Palestinians. So it would do what all clubs do. They would have meetings. They would host educational events. They'd invite speakers. You know, they may have protests and other actions to educate the community, but they would do whatever other student groups do.
There was a student named Safira Lurie last year who organized a rally on campus at Fordham to protest the ban on SJP. What happened to her?
So, yeah, Safira is one of our four petitioners, and she has since graduated from Fordham. After Dean Eldridge denied approval of the group, they were going to hold a protest. So some students talked to Dean Eldridge about the protest. He assigned a student liaison for the protest. He showed up at the rally. And then afterwards, he said that they had violated Fordham rules because they didn't get written approval. Fordham rules don't require written approval for a protest. So he charged Safira. He was holding a hearing, a disciplinary hearing. He was not only the target of the protest because of his decision, he was the complainant because he said they violated the rules. He was also going to be the decision maker about the disciplinary process. So Safira shows up with a lawyer from Palestine Legal and with her professor advisor. Dean Eldridge wouldn't let either of them accompany her. He was going to require the door to be shut with a sound machine on outside the door. And she said, I'm not going to do this. So they didn't have the hearing, and she ended up, you know, getting a warning. But it just shows the lengths to which Fordham will go to sort of stifle their speech.
Is this kind of harassment a national phenomenon? I know that Palestine Legal got 650 complaints between 2014 and 2016. Do you think that this reflects a growing popularity of the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
Absolutely, absolutely. As the movement continues to grow on campus and elsewhere, so does the effort to suppress it. You know you're doing something right when people don't even want you to speak. And you know there's no defense if that's the response.
What are the national implications of the current New York City lawsuit?
Well, I'm not sure if other private universities will be so shameless as to actually prevent an SJP from forming. I mean, there are about 180 groups on campuses across the country that support Palestinian rights. Most of them are Students for Justice in Palestine. But if they do consider that, I hope it will discourage them. But more importantly, I think it shows the courage and the persistence of students, you know, not only in seeking to form an SJP group, but also in bringing a legal challenge to the university to enforce their rights. And it also shows that groups like Palestine Legal and CCR will be there to support them when they do.
Are the members of Students for Justice in Palestine mostly Arab and Muslims?
It's a diverse mix. I think it depends. Again, they're on campuses all over the country. So there are Arab students, Muslim students, there are Jewish students, there are Christian students, there are white students, there are students of color, there are black students. So I think it's really a diverse mix. I mean, if you were to go on something like Canary Mission, which profiles Palestinian rights advocates in order to tarnish their reputations, you might think they're all Arab and Muslim or students of color because that's who they mainly profile. But it really is a diverse mix of students.
Supporters of Palestinian rights have observed sarcastically that there is a Palestine exception to the First Amendment. Is there any truth to this?
Yes, there is. And in fact, that's the title of CCR and Palestine Legal's report, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech. It's not the only exception, but again, when we have people speaking out against power, threatening power, silencing of that speech is often the reaction. It's, you know, it's not popular speech that's usually silenced. It's so-called controversial speech. So I think so.
How do you get a copy of that report?
You can go online, either on Palestine Legal's website or CCR's website, ccrjustice.org or palestinelegal.org.
Can you talk about Kenneth Marcus, who's coming up in the Department of Civil Rights, the kind of forces that are behind him?
Kenneth Marcus founded and is president of the Brandeis Center, which has been quite instrumental in bringing Title VI complaints against universities for essentially for Palestinian rights advocacy on campus, claiming that that is a hostile, makes a hostile environment for Jewish students. It's anti-Semitic. All of those complaints have been dismissed, and the Office of Civil Rights has said this is protected free speech, but that hasn't really stopped their efforts to suppress Palestinian rights advocacy on campuses. In fact, the Brandeis Center has also brought a case against the American Studies Association for their boycott of Israeli academic institutions, which is still ongoing. So now Kenneth Marcus is the nominee for Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights of the Department of Education. So he will actually be...
Steinem said is the fox guarding the hen house.
Yes, he will be in charge of enforcing civil rights on U.S. campuses. So, and, you know, he has the misunderstanding at best that that advocacy for Palestinian rights is somehow anti-Semitic when it's a movement that is based in equality. So that's potentially quite frightening.
Yeah, well, they make the equation between Israel and Judaism. And therefore, anything that Israel does that you don't like is therefore anti-Semitic. It's a false equation.
Right. Criticism of a nation state, certainly criticism of a nation state cannot be equated with either criticism of Israelis or, of course, not of Jewish people generally.
I see that the Israeli government has wrote up the list, but it's just recently been released about various organizations mm-hmm. in the United States whose leaders and activists are not going to be allowed to go to Israel.
Right.
We're talking about Jewish Voice for Peace, mm-hmm. The Quakers.
Yeah.
Ironically, the Quakers were the ones that helped Jewish refugees during the Second World War. I mean,
right.
it's a number of groups whose leaders are not
right.
going to be allowed to go to Israel. At the same time, Israel is allowing leaders of these right-wing, really fascist organizations in Europe, like mm-hmm. from France and from Hungary, to come to Israel.
Right.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, and just to say, National Students for Justice in Palestine is also one of those six groups from the U.S. that are named. I mean, again, it's just one of the many efforts to try to intimidate people and to suppress criticism of Israel. This affects activists, of course, but it also affects Palestinian students. You know, it can discourage people from getting involved in their SJP clubs if they're worried that they won't be able to go home. You know, we'll see what happens with that. Hopefully it can be challenged, but I encourage people to try to continue to go and visit Palestine for themselves and see what's happening there.
Maria LaHood, you've been counsel on the Olympia food boycott case, which is related to this. Talk about that, please.
So that case, you know, Olympia Food Co-op in Olympia, Washington, was the first business, I think, in the United States to actually boycott Israeli goods. And that was in 2010. The next year, they were threatened with suit if they didn't rescind the boycott. You know, the threat was by a few of the plaintiffs, but there's evidence that Stand With Us, in conjunction with the Israeli government, were actually behind the threat and the loss and the ultimate lawsuit. So the 16 former, they're all former board members now, but the former and current board members at the time were sued for the boycott of Israeli goods. We actually brought CCR brought an anti-SLAPP motion, which is strategic lawsuit against public participation, meaning that the suit was meritless and it was targeting protected speech. We won that. Judgment was that the defendants, who we were representing, would get over $250,000 worth of damages because the case was brought against them. They appealed. We won on appeal. And then they took it to the Washington Supreme Court, and the Washington Supreme Court struck down the anti-SLAPP statute.
Yeah.
So we were back down before the district judge, our fifth district judge, in fact. We moved to dismiss. We lost. We've been in discovery. And just last month, we moved for summary judgment, hopefully finally putting an end to the case. And we actually included with the motion for summary judgment, a resolution by the current co-op board, none of whom are defendants, saying this case is not in the best interest of the co-op, this case shouldn't have been brought, and it should be dismissed.
You know, these anti-BDS laws are being passed in a number of states, including New York State. And it was shocking to me because I remember boycott movement against apartheid in South Africa. And we just assumed you had a right to free speech, to be able to say to people, I'm not going to do business with them because it's a racist country. But in this instance, they're actually passing laws which allow discrimination against people who would boycott Israel, cutting off finances in New York. What's the prevalence of this, and why are they able to pass this just blatantly illegal kind of legislation?
Yeah, they are unconstitutional. I mean, there are, as of now, I think 23 states, almost half of the states in the United States, have passed some kind of anti-boycott laws dealing with Israel. You know, the American Jewish Committee has actually gotten all 50 governors of the states to sign their petition or pledge to oppose BDS and support Israel. In New York, there's an executive order, but there's also been legislation that they're trying to pass that's even worse than the executive order. Right now, there are cases challenging the legislation in Arizona and in Kansas that have been brought by the ACLU. So I think hopefully once these cases are decided, you know, it'll be clear to everyone that these laws are unconstitutional. I mean, there's also federal legislation that's been introduced, you know, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which would make supporting a boycott that is fostered by an international government organization like the UN or the EU punishable by exorbitant fines and up to 20 years in prison. I mean, it's really quite something. Hopefully that won't pass, but again, and hopefully it'll be clear soon to all of us, not just many of us, that the laws are unconstitutional.
Yeah, it reminds me of the adage, in as much as the United States government supports what Israel is doing, you lay down with dogs and you come up with fleas. Maria, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you on Law and Disorder. How did you get involved in this kind of litigation?
Well, you know, when I first started on these cases at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I first started at CCR in 2003, and it was actually a couple months after Rachel Corrie had been killed in Gaza, had been run over by a Caterpillar D9 bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier while she was trying to protect a home from being demolished while the family was inside. And that was in March of 2003. So I started in June of 2003, and on my first day, I actually was researching how can we bring a case against Caterpillar, which we later did, representing Cindy and Craig Corrie, her parents. We brought that in 2005. We also represented five Palestinian families who had been killed or injured when their homes were demolished on top of them. That case was subsequently dismissed after the U.S. government intervened and said, you can't hold Caterpillar liable because we actually pay for the bulldozers being given or being sold to Israel. So that would interfere with our U.S. foreign policy. So that was one of a few cases we brought that year, challenging Israeli war crimes, essentially. And I guess to bring it full circle, Cindy and Craig Corrie were actually at the Fordham hearing recently.
Oh,
so
no
that
kidding.
Was,
I
yeah,
didn't know
no,
that,
that
yeah.
was great. And I mentioned the Olympia Food Co-op case. Rachel and the Corries are from Olympia, and so that's, you know, it's all connected.
Yeah. And Michael Ratner was at the center when you brought that case.
Absolutely.
It adhered to one of his rules, which is don't be afraid to take a case even if you think you might lose it.
Yeah.
And just get a lot of publicity on the case and try to do some good.
Right. But, you know, these were cases, I think, if they were anywhere else besides Israel, we wouldn't have lost. You know, they're solid cases that should have been won had the courts been ready. And I think one of the things that I think is so important about supporting the Palestinian rights movement, it's about raising awareness and opening that space so that these conversations can happen and that justice for Palestine can actually be done eventually.
Maria LaHood, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.